Why not be happy? Why not be free? Why not be enlightened? I'll tell you why. Because of something we call attachment. We don't want to let go. We don't want to be free. We don't want to be happy. We don't want to be enlightened. We'd rather stay with all of our attachments. One of my favorite stories, based on the Buddha's teachings, which brings this point very clearly to your mind, is the story of the two monks. These two monks were the best of friends. They practiced together in the same monastery. They went together on tour. And when they died, one of those monks, because of their wonderful karma, got reborn in a beautiful heaven realm. Whereas the second monk, because of some bad karma, got reborn as a worm in a pile of cow poo. Even monks sometimes do wrong things, and this is why that monk got reborn as a worm in a pile of dung. It's not what we would call a fortunate rebirth. Now, these were two close friends. And so, the monk who was reborn in the heavenly realm, when he was enjoying that heavenly pleasures, he started to think of his old friend, the monk he spent many years together with as a close associate. He wondered, where has my friend been reborn? Now, when you get reborn in the heavenly realms, you can sometimes have psychic powers. And he was one such deva, one such heavenly being. So he used his magical powers to search for his friend. He looked all around the heavenly realms, and he couldn't find his friend anywhere in those realms. He thought, ah, my fellow monk must have even more good karma than I have. Surely he's been born in the fortunate realm of human beings. So he used his psychic powers to search through all of the human realm. He couldn't find any trace of his friend there either. Oh my goodness, he thought. Surely he can't have been reborn as an animal. But he had to check. He looked at the realms of the elephants and the cows and the dogs. Couldn't find his friend anywhere. Surely not a creepy crawly, he thought. And there, when he searched with his psychic powers, the realm of those beings who crawl along their bellies, there he found his friend, reborn as a humble worm in a pile of stinking cow poo. Oh my goodness, he thought, what an unfortunate rebirth. I can't, out of compassion, out of friendship, let my old friend suffer that rebirth. I have powers as a heavenly being. Perhaps I can come and rescue him. So the heavenly being appeared in front of that pile of cow dung. And he said, worm, worm, do you remember me? We used to be monks together in our previous life. Now listen to this. I've been reborn in the most beautiful of heaven realms. As for you, you've been reborn in this pile of stinking cow poo. That's not a very good rebirth. Come with me. I can use my powers to take you up to heaven. And the worm said, wait a minute. Before I go up to this heaven place, I want to ask one question. What is it, said the heavenly being, up in this heaven place, which you say is so wonderful and beautiful, is there any cow poo up there? And the heavenly being said, no, we don't have any stinking cow dung up in heaven. Well, if there's no cow poo up there, I'm not going, said the worm. Because the little worm likes cow poo. It's nice and warm. It's his food. It's like somebody being reborn who likes McDonald's hamburgers in the middle of a McDonald's hamburger shop. For those of you who like noodles, it's been like being reborn in a noodle shop. You can have all the noodles you like whenever you want. And so the little worm said, "Listen, thank you very much for your concern, but I'm quite happy here. What will I do up in heaven when there's no cow dung?" And the heavenly being tried to explain to him the difference between cow poo and heaven. But this little worm did not want to listen. He was quite happy with his cow dung. In fact, he was quite attached to it. So the heavenly being, not being able to persuade him with reason, decided to become more assertive. Very quickly, the heavenly being got hold of that worm between his fingers and started dragging him away from his pile of cow dung. "Hey, stop," said the worm. "Hey, help, I'm being kidnapped," or rather, worm-napped. And the worm started shouting and wriggling, trying his hardest to escape, because the worm just did not want to go. Now worms who live in piles of cow dung are smeared with the slippery, slimy stuff called cow poo. And because he was all slippery and slimy, and because he did not want to go, he wriggled this way and that until he escaped from the clutches of the heavenly being. And he went right into the middle of the cow dung, hiding in the pile. Now, friendship is very, very strong. If that's your best friend and they're in trouble, you do not give up that easy. So the heavenly being, with one hand, he pinched the end of his nose so he couldn't smell the awful smell. With his other hand, he dived into the pile of cow dung, searching here, searching there for this little worm. Eventually he found him and tried to pull him out again. And the worm started screaming again, "Hey, help, leave me alone." And he wriggled for his life. And soon the worm escaped again. This time he went deeper into the pile of cow dung. And the heavenly being tried again. Every time the heavenly being just about got the worm out of his pile of cow dung, the worm escaped and went right back into the middle again. After a long time, the heavenly being just had to give up. The little worm did not want to go. The pile of dung was his food. It was his home. It was his wealth. It was his fortune. And so the heavenly being had to leave the worm to his pile of dung and go up to heaven. And the little worm spent the rest of his life in his pile of stinking dung. When the Buddha told that story, he said, "You are all those little worms in your pile of dung." And the monks, the teachers, have been trying to pull you out for the last 3 days, all you people on retreat. I've been trying to pull you out of your pile of cow poo. Sometimes I got you pretty close, but you wriggle back out again, right back into your pile of dung. Why won't you go? Why won't you let go? Why won't you be at peace? Because you're attached to your pile of dung. "I don't want to go to Nibbana, leave me alone. I don't want to go to peace, I don't want to leave my body, my pile of dung. I don't want to let go of the five senses, I don't want to attain jhanas, I don't want to become enlightened." Why? Because the pile of dung, you don't realize how stinky and smelly it is. Sometimes people, "I don't want to become a monk. I don't want to become a nun." Why? Now that's what attachment is. So the only real way we can overcome attachment is either through, it's actually through trickery, basically. Because all of the words and explanation of the heavenly being to try and say, "Come with me, it's easy. Come up to heaven, I can take you." All the words describing what jhana is, describing what the peaceful meditation states are like, describing what stages of enlightenment are like, describing what stages of freedom and peace and happiness are like. No matter how you describe it, that will not be enough to take you away from your pile of dung. You like to think. Worry. Complain. I've been trying to take you out of that for the last 3 days. Do you want to go? No, because you like your thinking. Even your emotional world of unhappiness. I'm not sure if I told this story already here, but there's one of my disciples in Perth. She was from Bangkok, of a Chinese Thai family. Her mother would go every weekend to the Chinese movies. I'm not sure if they have the same Chinese movies these days, but the Chinese movies, similar to Western movies, were all about boy meets girl, and the two of them fall in love. But it's always the family get in the way. The parents do not approve. Now, in Western movies, usually what happens is that after a long troubles and strife, they get together in the end and they live happily ever after. But not in Chinese movies. In Chinese movies, the boy gets sent into the Imperial Army on the other ends of the earth. Or the girl gets killed. Or for somehow or other, the family just absolutely prevent a happy ending. And so all the Chinese movies have very sad endings. And this Thai girl's mother would come back every Saturday night with her eyes all red and sore with crying. Every Saturday she'd go to the movies to cry. And this Thai girl said, "What are you doing that for, Mum? Why are you going every week to suffer?" He said, "Oh, because I like it. I love to cry." "What do you do that for? You are attached to a pile of stinking cow poo." "But, oh, we like it. It's delicious. It's lovely. We love this." You boys, some of these boys go to these extreme sports where you go on a motorbike going upside down, where you go, snowboarding down precipitous slopes. Sometimes you go in these adventure world places where you go on these death drops, where you travel at the speed of terminal velocity, and only the last minute do you stop. You go on these rides which twirl you around upside down at great speed. Before, we used to call that torture. Now people pay to experience it. To scare the life out of themselves. To terrify themselves. Why do you do that? Because we don't realize we are attached to a pile of cow poo. Now, even if you say that, people say, "Oh yes, I'm telling you stories again." We have to trick you to somehow see something different. All the words and explanations, you might laugh at these words, but they do not make any difference to you. All the teachings which you may read, all the sermons you may listen to, all the discussions you might have, are not strong enough to cut your attachment to cow poo. All we need to do is somehow experience something different from this. So little by little, we practice this amazing path of the Buddha called letting go. Why not? It's because it's pleasurable. That's why we let go. Because it's happier. That's why we let go. Because we're freer. That's why we let go. Now the trouble is, we cannot let go of that pile of dung all in one go. So gradually we let go of it, little by little by little. And the Buddha taught the gradual path of letting go. That gradual part of letting go is teaching us that if we let go of a little bit of our kowtow, we feel that much lighter, that much happier, that much more free. So much so that we think, hey, this is the path to happiness in life, to freedom. Now what do we do? What is the first stage of letting go in Buddhism? The first stage of letting go in Buddhism is called putting something into the letting go boxes. We do not have donation boxes in Perth, Australia. We have letting go boxes. Letting go of such of your attachments. Out of kindness to you, we are receiving donations, so you have less burdens, less kaupu in the world. You know, Ajahn Chah once made a prediction. He made a prediction that one day, the world is going to run out of metal for coins. It's going to run out of paper for banknotes. And it's got to find some other material for the currency of our societies. And he predicted that in the future, what they would use in place of money would be chicken shit pellets. And people would work so hard for a bag of chicken shit at the end of the week. They would fill their pockets and their purses with chicken shit. They would guard their chicken shit and they'd try and steal other people's chicken shit. They'd go to the bank to get their chicken shit out. And we'll have a big international fund, the IMF, will change its name to International Manure Fund. What is the difference between paper and coins and pellets of chicken dung? Nothing. It's just the value we give on these things. And when he said that, it just started making us think, what are we working so hard for? Just for a bigger pile of chicken shit. Why are we attached to this? What is the purpose of money anyway? Is the purpose of money to accumulate so much stuff in the bank? You can't take it with you. Everyone knows that. Even though there was this man who, just before he died, he went to the Christian priest, he went to the Jewish priest, and he went to the Buddhist monk. He said, I'm not quite sure which one of you got the right religion, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you a big donation each on one condition. You put one, I'll give you $3,000 on condition that at my death, you'll all go to my funeral and you'll put $1,000 each into my coffin to take it with me for the other side. Even though the Christian priest, the Jewish priest and the Buddhist monk know you can't take anything with you, for $2,000 they would agree to anything. So when he came to the funeral, when he came to putting the money in the coffin, first of all, the Christian monk went in and put $1,000 cash. Then came the Jewish priest, who also took $1,000 in notes and put it into the coffin. Then came the Buddhist monk, who wrote out a check for $3,000, took $2,000 change, and went home. Do you get the joke? That's called wisdom. If you don't get the joke, I'll explain it to you afterwards. But what was there? You can't take it with you. You can't take checks with you. They just get burnt or buried. But anyway, that the purpose of money is actually what the Buddha said. A quarter of that money should be used for your pleasure, enjoyment. A quarter should be used for investing in your business. A quarter for a rainy day. And the other quarter to do good in the world, to do charity, to make merit. That's what the Buddha advised. Why do we say that? A lot of times it's not just for the sake of karma, good karma. A lot of times it's for abandoning attachments to the world. There's a story which I heard when I was young, which very much impressed me. It was concerning the Dalai Lama. Many years ago, while he was still in Tibet, he would go on tour of some of the poor parts of his country. Wherever he would go, people would line up to give him things, and he would accept whatever was given to him. On this occasion, there was an American journalist who was doing a story about the Dalai Lama, and this was a time when he wasn't famous. This American journalist started seeing all these people giving things to the Dalai Lama. Some of the people who gave him things were very, very poor. And the journalist knew the Dalai Lama lived in a palace, the Potala Palace, and never did without for anything. And the Americans started getting angry and upset. Why is this so-called holy man accepting all of these gifts? Surely holy people should live simply. What does he need with all this stuff? And eventually that American journalist's anger reached a peak. He could hold back no longer when he saw a very, very poor woman come and give the Dalai Lama a woman's skirt. And the Dalai Lama received it. An American journalist blew up in anger. What do you want with a woman's skirt? You're a monk, you're a man, for goodness sake. She needs it more than you. You should be giving it to her. What are you accepting these things for? That's not what a holy man should do. And in character, when someone abuses you and starts scolding you, you're quiet. You're peaceful. Because if you get angry back, you're just feeding the fires, and it takes longer for them to quiet down. When this American journalist had said his piece, the Dalai Lama looked at him and said, "Sir, you're right. I don't need a woman's skirt, but that woman needs to give it to me." And at that, the American journalist realized his mistake. The woman needed to give that to someone she respected. It doesn't matter whether the Dalai Lama needed it or not. She needed to give it. The Dalai Lama would take it to the next village and distribute it to another poor lady. And probably that particular poor lady would get another gift, which they received in the last village. Those gifts go round. The point is, it's not that you need that gift, but that person needed to give it to you. That's why as a monk, sometimes I have to encourage such letting go by receiving things that I just do not need. Even in Australia, sometimes it is cold. Sometimes people have offered me socks to wear. I never wear socks, except on special occasions. The special occasion was when one person, before the talk which I gave that evening, gave me a sock. Not one sock, a pair of socks, one for each foot. She wasn't that mean. So, before the talk, I made an exception. I put those two socks on. When I was giving the talk, I managed to, somehow or other, get my foot and stick it out. And in the corner of my eye, I saw this lady see my foot, and she said, "He's wearing my sock, he's wearing my sock." And that's why I did it. She needed to give it to me. She needed to see I was wearing my sock. And afterwards I put it away. She needed to give me something. Whether I wanted to wear it or not was beside the point. So I wore that for her happiness. She needed to let go. I needed to help her to let go. If anyone offers you anything, please accept it. If you don't need it yourself, they need to give it to you. And then you can go and give it to someone else who really does need it. But never stop an act of generosity. Acts of generosity are acts of spiritual power. They're holy acts. We should not stand in the way of something holy and good. We should not prevent someone making good karma. And that way we're encouraging something which is also called love. Have you ever known that if it's someone you love and care for, very often people want to express that love by giving things to them? Sometimes it's hard to say, "I really love you and how much I care for you." And sometimes we say it with a gift. You know what they say, that diamonds are a girl's best friend? But if you can't afford that, you can just give them a sock. But a gift is an expression of care, of love. That's why it's good to accept those gifts. As a monk, sometimes I have to accept things which I will never make use of. I have to be very careful in the times when I'm sick, not to let people know that I'm sick. Because if I let people know that I'm sick, everyone gives me their special medicine. And before they let me go, they will actually make me promise that I will take their medicine. It's bad enough at Dana time when people hover around the table and they say, take this, this is really good, I made it myself. I say, I've got this other food. Oh, don't worry about their food, take my food. So sometimes when I'm sick, I get so much medicine given to me, it makes me even more sick. Well, I accept it anyway and give it to somebody else. But the point is, you encourage not only love, which is another form of letting go, you also encourage just a generosity, which is part of letting go of our attachments. We want to share our material gains. Because when we share our material gains with those we care for and love, even if those people we care for and love are the Sangha of monks and nuns, we feel so happy. Why do you feel happy when you give a donation, when you give some charity, when you give some food, when you give some medicine for a monk? Why you feel happy is because it's an act of letting go, of selflessness, of giving up your attachments, the attachments to your material goods. Every time you do that, automatically happiness comes. That's why letting go is the path of happiness. Why let go? Because it makes us happy. My monastery in Perth is 1 hour from the city. Every day, people come to feed the monks in my monastery. There are 20 monks in that monastery. There's about usually 7 or 8 people in training to be monks. There's usually about 3 lay visitors, 3 women visitors. There's usually about 30 people in that monastery. Well, Dr. U was there a few days ago. He knows just how every day we get more than enough food there. We get heaps of food. We don't have to cook anything ourselves. Lay people come every day, 1 hour. That's only driving. They have to prepare the food, get up early, sort of make special arrangements, drive all that way. Even when they offer the food, they have to wash up afterwards. It's the only place where you invite people to dinner and get them to do the washing up afterwards. And sometimes, I know the answer, but I ask them, why do you do this? Why do you come all that way to look after the Sangha, to serve the monks? And what I get, the answer is always the same. Happiness. I feel so good after coming to help. Because it's an act of letting go, one gets happiness. The more one has to let go, the harder it is, the more happiness one gets. If it's just putting a donation in the box, that's not much letting go. That's easy to do. If it's actually taking, cooking all that food, bringing it all that way, looking after the monks, serving them, and then going back again, that takes a whole morning. That's why giving such dana is more meritorious than writing out a check. The amount of effort required is greater. Therefore, it's more letting go. Therefore, it creates greater happiness. Why let go? Because you need to let go to grow in happiness and to grow in love and caring. Sometimes we're going to go off into the compassion part of letting go now. I mentioned the other day that the word for letting go, forgiving, is called liberality. And a person who is liberal is someone who gives, who's got liberality. The word for freedom is liberation. And the German word for love is Liebe. All coming from the same word. In fact, I hope you'll be able to see that giving, loving, letting go, freedom, all comes from the same idea. Because the next way of letting go is called compassion. It's selflessness. You're letting go of your concerns, of your happiness and suffering, for the sake of another being. You're saying to them, son, daughter, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're giving them unconditional love. That includes this wonderful gift of letting go called forgiveness. It don't care what you've done in the past, whether you've got into trouble, whether you've said the wrong things, you've done the wrong things, you haven't done your duties to me, your father, to me, your mother. I will let go of that past. Letting go. I will free you from that past. Liberation. I love you enough to forgive. Compassion. Isn't compassion about forgiving? Isn't letting go about allowing the past to disappear? Isn't freedom the way of releasing the prisoners of the past? All coming from the same thing. So when we learn how to let go, we start to also learn how to forgive. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if when we make a mistake, people would understand that we're only human. Everyone makes a mistake sometime, so we should forgive one another. We acknowledge, we forgive, and we learn never to do the same mistake again. Many times, but I remember one occasion. When I was walking through the grounds of my monastery in Australia, I came across a hammer which had been left out in the grass. It must have been left out there for many days because it was going rusty. I was the abbot at the time, and I thought that I should give my monks an object lesson to teach them how to look after gifts of generosity, because I knew that that hammer would have been given by one of our lay supporters to help us build our monastery. And I knew that some of those supporters didn't even have a job. Sometimes they had to save up for many weeks to buy something like a hammer for us. We didn't have wealthy disciples. The monastery wasn't just built by just one extremely wealthy person. Many, many little people would give a little here, a little there, to build my monastery in Australia. And there that some stupid, careless monk had left that hammer out into the grass as if it wasn't valuable at all. So I brought all the monks together that evening. Sometimes you've heard me here giving very soft talks with lots of jokes. That evening there was no jokes. I really laid it on the line. If you're going to be monks, living on the generosity, on the charity of others, you should look after those gifts which you're given. You can't. This is not on. This is not acceptable that you leave a hammer or anything which is given as a gift of charity by other people out in the grass to get rusty, to get ruined. You should make better look after these gifts. Otherwise, you don't deserve charity. You didn't work for that hammer yourself. You didn't pay for it. That was a gift of charity. Out of respect for you being a monk, you should look after those gifts. Now, what I said was much, much fiercer than that. And at the end of that talk, all the monks were sitting dead straight. Not one was laughing. They were all white. I really gave a fire and brimstone sermon that night. But what really disappointed me was not one of those monks confessed that it was them. I really thought that, okay, I was a bit tough, but I wouldn't sort of, you know, hurt any monk. I wouldn't punish them. If they'd have said, yes, it was me, I'm terribly sorry, I would have forgiven them. I'm a soft monk. I've got compassion. But I was disappointed. For those moments, I actually lost faith in my fellow monks. Why couldn't they just say that it was them? One of them must have done it. Why didn't they actually confess? Put their hand up and said, look, I'm terribly sorry, Ajahn Brahm. It was me. I'll try never to do it again. So when I left that hall, that talk, I felt so dispirited. I thought I'd lost my faith in my fellow monks. Not one would confess to doing that act of mindlessness. And it was only when I got out the door, I suddenly realized why none of those monks had confessed. Because I suddenly remembered who left that hammer out in the grass. You got it, it was me. And I completely forgot about it, went out of my mind. Even though I was giving that talk, I couldn't remember at all. So I had to go back in the hall, sit down a minute, monks, I'm terribly sorry, I've got a confession to make. It was me. One of the most embarrassing moments of my life. But I confess that my penance now is actually to tell that story many times, in different locations. I make mistakes. Don't you make mistakes? Hands up here, anyone who's never made a mistake. So can't we let go enough to forgive? To have compassion? To look upon other people like ourselves? To look upon ourselves like other people? To forgive the past? You do not need to be the executioner, as I said last night. If someone has done something bad, you can forgive them. If it's something bad, karma will get them. If it's not karma, sort of after death, if they're a Christian, they get punished by God. If they're a Muslim, they get punished by Allah. If it's a Hindu or a Buddhist, karma will get them. And if they don't believe in anything, they will have to go in therapy for many years for what they've done. Whatever, you know there's a punishment there for them. So you don't need to be the punisher. You can forgive. It's called letting go. It's part of a path of letting go. Why let go? Because it is in everybody's interest to forgive. The Buddha said, hatred never ceases with hatred. It only ceases through forgiveness. One of the stories, which was a powerful story. Some people say, okay, if you leave a hammer out in the grass, that's nothing, you can forgive that. It was one of my disciples in Australia. When she came home from work one day, she found a policeman in her house, waiting for her. Her children weren't there, nor was her husband. Her husband had been arrested that day for sexually abusing her two 11-year-old twins. Sexual abuse. That is a crime. She didn't see it. She couldn't notice it. It was found out from one of the teachers at school who noticed the signs. They asked the kids with a school psychologist, counselor, and it was true. Her husband, who up until that point she loved very dearly, was discovered to have been sexually abusing her two children for several years. When that happens, the husband has to go to jail. The children have to go into counseling, and so does she. Because she was a student of mine, because she was a Buddhist, a meditator, her response was out of the ordinary. First of all, she felt terribly guilty. Her job as a mother was to love and look after her children. She felt she'd failed in her duty. The signs were there, but she hadn't picked them up. She thought she should have done. For those of you who know psychology, sometimes that things are so terribly, terribly awful that the worse they are, the harder they are to see. Even though the signs would have probably been picked up by a normal person, she couldn't see them because if they were true, it would mean her family was devastated. It would mean the man she loved would have been doing these terrible things that was just too hard to comprehend. So she had gone into denial. She just could not see what was plainly obvious to other people. It was nothing wrong with her. It was just the psychology of facing up to something which is so horrendous that we push it back, way behind our conscious mind. Because she was a Buddhist, she knew how to forgive. Very quickly, she forgave herself. It was obvious that she didn't need punishing. It happens to many women. They just can't see, because it's just too horrendous to see. She forgave herself. And next, she forgave her husband. That was the hard one. She told me at the time she could never love that man again. That man could never be her partner. But she would not hate him. She would not seek revenge. She forgave. She let go. Because she let go, very quickly, her 2 11-year-olds, who usually take their parents as their guides, also let go and forgave their father for the terrible things he did. It was law that the whole family had to have individual separate counseling from an accredited psychotherapist who was learned in that area of sexual abuse. Eventually, this lady came to me and said, "Please, please help. I can't get free of this therapist. This therapist keeps asking me, 'You hate your husband, don't you?' I said, 'No, no, I've forgiven.' 'You hate her, don't you?' 'No, no, I've forgiven.' 'You're in denial again.' 'No, no, I've forgiven.' This therapist could not believe that someone in that situation had forgiven so quickly. So I had to go and see that therapist and explain to her Buddhist compassion and forgiveness. Until that therapist could understand that this was an exceptional case, the Buddhists have got another way of dealing with these problems, which was very strange, was nothing she'd been taught before, but which was true. The woman forgave so quickly, so was free from the therapy very quickly, and I've kept in contact with her. She moved to England, to Essex. She always writes to me maybe once or twice a year. That one of the daughters now, several years ago, has now had a daughter herself. This woman is now a grandmother. The children did not keep the trauma of that experience. The children were not severely affected by what would usually severely affect the lives of children. Forever, for the rest of their lives. Because she forgave that quickly, she did the best possible thing for herself and her 2 kids. That's one example amongst others. To let go, to forgive, is a sensible way for the greater happiness of everybody concerned. If we don't do that, we are carrying around pain unnecessarily, year after year, sometimes for the rest of our lives. Which is why it is compassionate for ourselves and other beings to let go of the past. We learn letting go stage by stage, as I was saying. We let go stage by stage, first of all by just giving charity, then by serving, then by keeping our precepts, by compassion. Compassion is all ways of letting go, forgiving, being kind. Isn't that a kind thing to do? To forgive others their faults? Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if you can forgive your faults? First of all, we forgive others, and then when we realize how wonderful it is to let go of others' faults, we may have the inspiration to let go of our own faults. All of those of you who've been meditating the last 3 days, those of you having a difficult time, why are you having a difficult time? Because you haven't let go of your past. You have a difficult meditation and you can't let it go. This is difficult, this is difficult. It is not difficult, it was difficult. Any moment you can let go of your past and be free of whatever has happened so far in this meditation retreat. In meditation we call this the beginner's mind. A beginner's mind is one who's completely let go of the past. How many years have you been meditating, Ajahn Brahm? Zero. When you let go of the past, you are a beginner. When you let go of the past, you are free from that past. Are you a good meditator or a bad meditator? You're free when you have the beginner's mind. To be wise, you have to let go of everything you've been taught. All that you've been taught before, has that led to your enlightenment yet? Do you really know what the Dharma is? Have it lead to ultimate freedom, to happiness, to peace? If it hasn't, maybe it's wrong. The trouble is, when we are wrong, we can't see it. Other people, we can see we're wrong, but we can't see we're wrong. Think about this. No one can think they are wrong. It's impossible, illogical, irrational. It cannot happen that you think you're wrong. All you can do is think you were wrong, and you think you're right about that. Everything you think, every thought, is by its very nature assumed to be correct. Analyze that with insight. That's one of the reasons why people just can't see they're making mistakes. How many people are enlightened in this room? Why? Are you wise? Do you think you know? Do you understand the Four Noble Truths? The Buddha said, if you understand the Four Noble Truths, you'll be fully enlightened. Why aren't you fully enlightened? You think you understand the Four Noble Truths, but you don't. That's why we have to let go of everything we've been taught, to be free and see the Dhamma. How do we let go of everything we've been taught? We do that by letting go of thinking, of thought, because thought is always old stuff. We think in the way we thought before. We think in words and concepts we've been taught before. We don't think in new ways. We can only see in the silence in new ways. The next part of letting go after compassion is letting go of thoughts. Why is it that sometimes people, when they hear something, they say, that's wrong? They're not listening. They are reacting. So, the next thing we have to let go of, to follow the path, is to let go of all this chatter inside, so we can truly listen. There was a survey done in the United States. It was recorded in Time magazine. They found that 95% of people who were listening to public talks were thinking sexual fantasies at the time. No one was really listening. They were listening to the first minute. They were listening to the end. And in the middle, they were thinking of something completely different. It might not be sexual fantasies. It might be the dinner waiting for you afterwards. It might be anything other than what's really happening. Because we don't know how to listen in silence, that's why we never hear anything. We never hear the Dhamma because we're talking back at it. How many of you have a good relationship with your husband, with your wife? How many of you can really communicate with your partner or with your children? To communicate means that someone is talking and someone else is listening. Usually, both parties are talking at the same time. One party is talking with their mouth, the other one is talking with their brain. The husband is saying, darling, we need to go out to see our friend this evening. And the wife is thinking, not him again. Don't you know what happened last time? Don't you know I'm tired? Don't you know we've got to do something else? One person is talking, the other person is complaining. Or the wife is saying to the husband that we need a new vacuum cleaner. And she's saying, here she goes again, nag, nag, nag. Don't you know that I'm tired? We can't afford a vacuum cleaner. She said this before, blah, blah. One person is talking, the other person is thinking. No one is listening. That's why there's no communication. To be silent is to listen. This is how we learn how to let go, so we can listen to the world. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could stop our thoughts whenever we wanted? For example, when someone abuses you, when they call you a name, there's many words of abuse, which is a monk, I cannot repeat. So I use the word camel face. If someone comes up to you and say, hey, camel face, would you get upset? If you get upset, what happens is you think, why did they call me camel face? I haven't got a face like a camel. They should not call me camel face. And every time you think of that, you call yourself camel face another time. Someone called you camel face and you stop, you don't think about it, you let go, then you're free of the abuse which they just gave you. You don't even remember it. You've let it go. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way of dealing with abuse in the world? I had to learn that when I became a monk and went to the West, when I went to Australia. 20 years ago, no one knew what a monk was. Sometimes at the airport, you go into the men's toilet, they look at you and say, no, you're supposed to go in that one, the women's, because that's what you look like. I remember one occasion, I was loading up some things for our monastery outside our city centre. It was the first or second year as a monk. This 13-year-old girl came out of her house, and she looked me up and down with utter disgust. And she wrinkled her nose, and she clenched her teeth in a grimace and said, ugh, you're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck. She tried to abuse me. And all I did, I thought it was terribly funny, so I laughed. You let it go. What's wrong with someone calling you a girl? Actually, they're quite right, because I did look like a girl. And another time, I'd just given a talk in a school, in a girls' school in Perth. It just happened that 2 days later, I was walking down one of the roads, the central streets of Perth, on some business. And these girls came up to me, and they say, hi, you're the monk who came to our school 2 days ago to give a talk on Buddhism. And I said, actually, I'm very impressed, I'm very flattered that you remember me. And the girl said, oh, we'll never forget you. Oh, really? Yeah, we'll never forget anyone called Bra. I said, there's an M on the end. It's Brahm. Again, they were just trying to upset me. But I enjoyed the joke. I let it go. I did not take it personally. When you make a fool of yourself and people laugh at you, always laugh as well. Then the world never laughs at you. They can only laugh with you. When you make a mistake or someone sort of, you're an idiot, and the world laughs at you, you laugh as well, then the world is only laughing with you, never at you. So you let go of pride. You let go of thought. We can make mistakes, and then we can be so much at peace with our life. But more importantly, when you start letting go of thinking, when you have a bit of silence, my goodness, it feels so good. Silence is golden, and the price of gold, so I hear, is going up in the world. So how about investing in golden silence? You know, all religions respect silence as sacred. If you go to the cathedrals in Europe, as a young man, even though I wasn't interested in Christianity, I was always inspired by those cathedrals. You know why? Because you went inside them, they were so silent. In the streets of the cities, it was noisy. You went inside, and it was so quiet. It was holy, that silence. If you go in the best monasteries, they're quiet, they're silent. If you go into the caves, the mountains, the places where holy hermits become enlightened, they're silent. Because in that silence is a huge amount of happiness. All your worries, all your concerns, all stress is all made of the words inside your brain, the thinking, the worries, the anxieties, the fears. Wouldn't it be wonderful to let go of all of that? We let go in this meditation. This is what meditation is, for those of you who haven't heard of Sidney before. So eloquent from Ajahn Chah himself. You can try this at home if you like. Get a cup of water, pick it up, hold it out in front of you, and see how heavy it gets the longer you hold it. If I hold this for 5 minutes, it starts to feel quite heavy. If I hold this for half an hour, I start to feel pain. If I keep holding this for 2 hours, you'd have to take me to hospital because I'm a very stupid monk. What should I do when it starts to get heavy? Let go. Sometimes people say, oh, if you let go, everything will go wrong. You don't let go forever. You hold a cup for 5 minutes, you let it go for, say, 20 seconds. You pick it up again afterwards. Yeah, it works again. It feels lighter. Why does it feel lighter? Is the weight of this cup changed at all? No. It feels lighter because you have rested. The thoughts in our mind cause the stress of our life. Because we don't know how to let go of those thoughts. Because those thoughts obsess us all day, all night. That's why we feel stress. All we need to do is let them go for a few minutes. We can pick them up again afterwards. They're easy to bear. That's why letting go is practiced in the great corporations of our world. Executives in multinational companies have time out rooms. Rooms where they're allowed to go, where they cannot take any mobile phones. Mobile phones can't reach there. Secretaries can't reach there. Top executives go into those timeout rooms to let go of their burdens for a few minutes. Full relaxation, no work, no telephones, no computers. The corporations have built those rooms into their headquarters because they know that those executives, if they get stressed, they make mistakes which will cost that company millions of dollars. If those highly trained and experienced executives get a coronary, a heart attack, they're out of action for many days, sometimes forever if they die. It is worth the company's time to allow those top executives to put down their burden, to let go, so that they can later carry that burden without making mistakes, without stress. It's just company efficiency to let go of thinking from time to time. It's worth your while for wisdom, for sanity, to let go of your worries and concerns from time to time. If you don't, you will go mad. And you know the sign of temporary insanity? Well, I told you the other day about the story of the husband who went to the market and that man who hit his head or got angry at the husband. Remember that story, don't you? Temporary insanity? I told that, didn't I? Really? Okay, here comes another story. This is to do with anger and letting go. A husband Paddyarthur not work? Please interrupt me if I tell. I thought I had told this, but never mind. A husband had the afternoon off work. So his wife said, "Darling, we're short of eggs, and I need some eggs for dinner. Would you mind going to the market to buy some eggs for me?" "Certainly, darling," said the husband. "I don't mind getting some eggs for you. But please let me know where the market is, because I've never been there before, and what to do." So the wife gave him some money, a basket, told him where the market was, and off he went. When he entered the market, a young man came up to him and started calling him camel face and things much worse, and started scolding and abusing him. And this husband said, "Look, I don't even know you. Why are you scolding me and abusing me and calling me all these terrible names in front of everybody?" But that never stopped this young man. This young man started shouting at him, abusing him, calling him some terrible names that no monk can ever repeat. And this poor husband was so upset at being abused and scolded for no reason, he got so angry, he turned around and went back home. When he got back home, his wife said, "Oh, you're back early, darling. Did you get the eggs?" "No. I never want to go back to that stupid market ever again. People are just so horrible there." And the wife allowed him to calm down. All those of you who've got husbands know you never get any sense of them when they are in that sort of mood. You've got to calm them and soothe them first of all. And then that's what she did. She soothed her husband. Then she asked him, "What did that man look like?" And the husband described him. And the wife said, "Oh, it's him. He does that to everybody. He's crazy. He's mad. When he was young, he fell down and hit his head. From that time on, he's never been able to go to school. He's never been able to get a job. He'll never be able to get married. We just let him roam around the market during the day. Because he's crazy, he goes and calls me camel face and many worse things. Sometimes he calls someone else these rotten names. He scolds everybody from time to time, but don't worry about him. He's crazy. He's not in his right mind. He's mad." When the husband heard that, all his anger and being upset just disappeared. How can you get angry at being scolded by someone who's crazy? In fact, he felt compassion for the young man. Being mad, being crazy, never being able to go to school or get a job. So the wife saw that and said, "Husband, look, I really do need those eggs. Can you please take the basket and go to that market? And don't worry about that crazy man." And he said, "Okay, I understand now." He took the basket, went back into the market, and this young crazy man came out to him again, called him terrible names, swore at him, abused him in a loud voice in front of everybody. But he wasn't embarrassed anymore. He wasn't hurt anymore, because it was only coming from a crazy man. He went up to the market, to the egg market, asked for the eggs. This man followed him, abusing him all the way. The lady said, "Look, don't worry about him. He's only mad. He hit his head when he was young." "Yes," said the husband, "I've just been told." And even though this young man abused and scolded and shouted and swore at him all the way out of the market, it didn't matter anymore, because the husband knew he was crazy. When the Buddha told that story, he said, "All you wives, if your husband scolds you and calls you names, always remember he must have hit his head that day. He's crazy. He's mad. And if husbands, if your wife scolds you, it's called temporary insanity. She's crazy. She's mad. Who in their right mind would call the one they love camel face, stupid, you idiot, whatever else they call you?" So, when anyone scolds you or calls you names or tries to wind you up by calling Ajahn brah, oh, those girls must have hit their head that morning. They're crazy. That's called temporary insanity. Anyone who gets angry and scolds you, please remember that they are temporary insane. Crazy with the fires of greed, hate and delusion, as the Buddha said. That way, you never take it seriously when people shout abuse at you. You can let it go out of wisdom. You don't need to dwell upon it. You can forgive. you can make your mind peaceful. Anyone who's hurt you in the past, temporary insanity. If you made any mistakes, you were temporarily insane. So you're out of your mind. Forgive yourself. Insanity is an excuse where you don't need to be prosecuted in the court of law. You can forgive. You can let go. In that silence, you let go of the past. You find a great sense of freedom and happiness. Silence is happiness. Letting go is joy. Because I was been saying this morning, the powerful teaching of meditation, of Buddhism, if instead of using all your energies, wasting all your life, thinking, blaming, worrying, being anxious, grieving over the past, anxious over the future, how much energy do you waste in useless thinking? That is why you feel tired. That is why so many people have no energy in their lives. We feel worn out at our wit's end sometimes. So tired because we think inefficiently. Imagine if that energy was not being wasted over silly things. All that energy will be there for your mind. Mental energy is called happiness. One of the reasons why people aren't happy these days, why it's hard to see people smiling, is because people are worn out. They're grumpy because they're tired. We shout and criticize our husband and wives, our children, our parents even, because we're so tired. Imagine if we could let go. Let go of those things we don't need to think about. We'd have so much more energy in our life. So much more happiness in our mind. Mental energy is happiness. Happiness is mental energy. When I'm happy, I'm so energetic. When I'm energetic, I'm happy. Knowing that, you'll find that by letting go of excess thinking, you are creating greater happiness in your life. If you can really let go of thinking by making your mind absolutely still in meditation, you get great happiness. That happiness which comes in meditation, when I was saying a couple of days ago, the great marketing slogan of meditation, that marketing slogan is, the pleasure of deep meditation is greater than sex. When I say that, everyone says, I'm interested. And I mean that. Why is that happiness of meditation greater than the biggest happiness to be found in the world? It's the happiness of letting go. Why not let go? Because there's so much happiness to be found in letting go. When you let go, it's like being in a balloon. You're throwing out all of the ballast, all the weight, all the attachments. And you fly higher and higher and higher. Happier and happier and happier. Didn't I say earlier about the simile of the worm and a pile of dung? There is a heaven world inside of you. Enlightenment, freedom, liberation, happiness. Nibbana, said the Buddha, is the ultimate happiness. The extreme happiness of which there is no happier experience in the world. Nibbanang paramang sukhang, said the Buddha. Nibbana, the ultimate happiness. So, as you let go more and more, you get happier and happier and happier. It really depends on how much happiness you can stand. If you let go a lot, you get happiness a lot. If you let go extremely, you get extreme happiness. If you let go ultimately, you have ultimate happiness. Don't you want to be happy? Didn't I say the Four Noble Truths is happiness, its cause, unhappiness, and the cause of unhappiness? This is what Buddhism is all about. Happiness. Ultimate happiness. And the cause of that ultimate happiness is letting go. This is the start of Buddhism, the middle of Buddhism, and the end of Buddhism. So, try it out and see. The more you let go, the happier you feel. You let go a little, you feel a lot of joy. Let go a lot, immense joy. And anyway, you're going to have to let go eventually. Just before you go in your box, in your coffin. You're going to have to let go of your body, or your wealth, and everything else. Do you remember the story of the man with the four wives? The man with the four wives. In the old days, men were so stupid. They not only had one wife, they had many wives. Having one wife is suffering enough. Four wives, quadruple suffering. My goodness, he was stupid. So, this man had four wives. When he was getting very old, he was about to die. He knew he was going to die soon. And he thought that when he goes to the other side, he was so attached to his wives, he thought, when I die, I'd be so lonely. So he called in his latest wife, his fourth wife, which he'd married very late in life. Now she was very, very beautiful, this young woman. She was so beautiful, it got him into many exclusive events. It was a passport into the highest of society. And many people wanted her. So, he called her in. Said, fourth wife, I'm about to die. I've worked so hard for you. I love you very much. Even though you came to me late in life, you're my passport to so much happiness. Will you come with me after I die? And she said, what? It's never been done. I'm not going to do it. No way. And she stormed out of the bedroom. To him, it was like a dagger to his heart. He loved her so much, and he found that she really didn't love him. But never mind, he had three more wives. So he called in his third wife. He'd also married her, so later on in life. And she was very attractive also. Many, many people wanted her. In fact, probably more people wanted his third wife than wanted his last wife. And again, his third wife made many things possible. So he brought in his third wife, said, darling, I've worked so hard to marry you too. You're so wonderful. You make so many things possible for me. Will you come with me after death? And she looked at him and said, come with you after death? No. When you die, I'll probably go with one of your sons. Oh, he was devastated. What? Such infidelity? I'm not even dead yet. And he always saying, you're going to go with one of my sons. Get out of the room, you hussy. And he sent her out of the room. So he brought in his second wife. His second wife, he'd been married to for such a long time, he couldn't remember when he wasn't without her. His second wife, she'd been his advisor, always there to help him in difficult times, always someone to give good advice and to go to. He actually loved her in a different way than his other two wives. So, he asked her, he said, darling, I've known you for such a long time. You've been always so wise and so helpful. When times have been difficult, you're the one I've turned to. You're the one who's helped me. Will you go with me after death? Because I'll be so lonely without you. And quite gently she said, look, I would like to, but I'm sorry, I can't. All I can do is go to your graveside. I can go no further. And he was again so disappointed. His second wife also didn't love him as much as he thought. He sent her out, disappointed, despondent. But he still had one wife left, his first wife, and he couldn't remember the time he'd been without his first wife. He brought her in. Actually, his first wife was a power behind the scenes. But he looked at her, while all the other wives had nice clothes. She was in rags. But all the other wives were well-fed. She was thin and scrawny. He'd neglected her, especially over the last few years of his life. But he still recognized how much she could do for him. So she said, "Wife, I know that I've neglected you over the last few years, and I know that you're so powerful behind the scenes. Will you go with me after death?" She smiled and said, "Certainly. I always go with you, wherever you go. Otherwise, why would my name not be Mrs. Karma?" Because that was his first wife's name, Mrs. Karma. Wherever you go, your karma goes with you. She was the power behind the scenes. Even though his last few years she neglected her, she had to go with him. The second wife, who could only go as far as the graveside, who was always there for him in times of trouble, was his advisor, was called Mrs. Family. Mrs. Family is always there for you in times of trouble and difficulty. But can your family go with you past the grave? They will go to your graveside. They will do the funeral service, but they can't go further. The third wife he'd married later on in life was called Mrs. Money. Mrs. Money made many things possible. He'd worked so hard to marry Mrs. Money. But when he died, Mrs. Money would go with one of his sons. The sons would inherit Mrs. Money, and you cannot take Mrs. Money with you into the grave or past the grave. And the last wife was Mrs. Fame. Mrs. Fame opened the doors to many, many great places for you. And he loved Mrs. Fame. He'd married Mrs. Fame so late in his life. But can Mrs. Fame go with you to your next life? No. So that's the story of a man with four wives. Mrs. Karma, Mrs. Family, Mrs. Money, and Mrs. Fame. Mrs. Fame will not go with you, nor will Mrs. Money, nor will Mrs. Family. But Mrs. Karma, or Mr. Karma, he goes with you everywhere, from life to life. So which wife, which husband is the most important to look after? Not fame, not wealth, not even family. Mrs. or Mr. Karma. That's the story of the man with four wives. So we let go of those other things so we can cultivate the important things of life to get happiness, to get peace, to get freedom. So don't be like the worm stuck in your piles of dung. There's other things to go for. Greater happiness than dung. So, I've taught you today about letting go of piles of dung. Generosity, compassion, giving your precepts. Becoming quiet, silent. Letting go of anger. Letting go of what people say about you. These are all ways of letting go. To create happiness. To free yourself from the dung of anger, ill will, craving. The source of things which stop you being happy, which stop you being successful. So, that's letting go. Now, I will let go and ask, are there any questions? Okay, there are actually some questions here. So, if you don't mind, I'll ask some of the questions which are on pieces of paper first of all. Or has anyone got a question from the floor? Maybe first. Is there any questions from the floor? Remember, if you don't ask questions, you'll be stupid in the next life. Okay. Just the questions here. Question number one. In the threefold training of Sila, Samadhi and Panya, Sila is the foundation for all. Does it mean that the development of Samadhi and Panya depend upon the... Does it mean that the perfection of Sila... Does it mean that the development of samadhi and panya depend upon the perfection of sila, or do the three progress together? Can it be the other way around, as in panya, samadhi, sila? Okay, what happens actually? Practice sila, samadhi, panya. Sila is letting go of stupid actions of body and speech. If anyone was wise, they would never break any precepts. As I said yesterday, all the precepts, what we call sila, is not doing anything which hurts yourself or hurts another person. Who in their right mind would hurt themselves or hurt another person? That's why if you break precepts, again, it's temporary insanity. You're crazy to break precepts. So wisdom makes for sila, for precepts. That's the first stage of letting go. Wisdom then lets go. Sorry, samadhi is letting go of thinking, letting go of movement, being still. That's why these states of joy and bliss in meditation, which people have a great, wonderful time with, these are states of letting go. The four jhanas are the four stages of letting go, which is why when anybody says you can get attached to those jhanas, they're talking rubbish. You cannot get attached to letting go, no more than you can get attached to precepts. And wisdom, I mentioned a lot of wisdom today. Wisdom to let go of the past. Wisdom to let go of the hurt of the past. To forgive. To be kind. To be compassionate. That's wisdom. So the progress is sila leads to samadhi, leads to panya. That is the usual progress. Okay. Second question. In the Noble Eightfold Path, Samaditi, right understanding, was mentioned first by the Buddha, and only then followed by the other seven factors. Does this mean that right understanding is the most important factor in the Noble Eightfold Path, or are all factors equally important? All factors are important, but right view is the first one which is fully perfected. In this path, when we start, we have a bit of this, a bit of that. But right view is the first of the factors to be fulfilled. It's called entering the stream, being a stream winner. When you have a stream winner, you've seen the Dhamma. You have right view only when you're an Aryan, a stream winner, the first days of enlightenment. Before then, you haven't got right view. You haven't seen. You might think you've got right view. All you've got is right thoughts. You've got, you know, right. If you're lucky, that is, if you manage to sort of believe in some of what the Buddha says and understand it, you've just got right opinions, or wrong opinions mostly. But after a while, when you see the Dhamma, it surprises you, it shocks you, it sees something you never expected. It's okay, as I gave a simile the other day, it's okay to read a guidebook about Paris. You may even see a video on your TV about Paris. You may even do a doctorate thesis on Paris. But if you haven't been to Paris, you don't know what Paris is like. The same way about right view. You may read about right view in the Buddha's teachings. You might do a doctorate on right view. You may research right view. But until you've been there, you don't know what right view truly is. Once you get right view, you have to get right thought. Which is again letting go of sensuality, letting go of ill will, letting go of cruelty. From that you have to keep precepts, they're natural. There's no way you cannot keep your precepts of right speech, right action, right livelihood. Only then can there really be right effort, going into mindfulness, not going into the doer. Only when right effort goes into mindfulness, does mindfulness, samasati, be fulfilled. And only when mindfulness is fulfilled, as I've been teaching this retreat, all the attention going into the knowing, none into the doing, only then do the jhanas appear. You don't make the jhanas. You let the jhanas happen by letting go. That part of the Eightfold Path is sequential. Next question. If a person is stricken with a fatal disease, it is not easy to ask him to practice the knowing and to accept, come what may. The doer is bound to be busy with worries, heartaches, etc. Further, he may also desire to die and end his life and end his and his loved ones' sufferings. But such a thought creates bad karma. Thank you, Ajahn. Everyone here is stricken with a fatal disease called life. As one person famously said, life, the definition of life, that life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Think about it. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. You are all terminal cases. So you are stricken with a fatal disease called life. But if someone is close to death, I think they're saying, you say it's not easy to ask them to practice the knowing. My goodness, that's the easiest time in the world. When you're about to die, surely it's quite clear you're not going to be able to take your house with you. You're not going to be able to take your business with you. You're not going to be able to take your bank account with you. They do not have any ATMs up in heaven. You can't even take your credit card up there. It's not accepted. Except your, not your Visa card, not your Express card, not your daughter's card. There's one credit card you can take to heaven. Your karma card. If you have a gold karma card, you've made lots of good karma, then you can do anything. You can go anywhere. That's the gold card. Those of you going on this meditation retreat, your applications for your gold karma card are in. If you complete this retreat and you do well, you'll receive your gold karma card. Unlimited transactions possible. But here we go. So it should be the most easy thing when somebody is dying to teach them Dhamma. Because naturally they know they have to let go of attachments. They know this body is going to go. They know they're about to die. They know they can take nothing with them. Surely the teachings of the Buddha are never so clear, so obvious to someone who's about to die. Which is why that many people at death, when they hear the Dhamma, can become enlightened. The teaching of the Buddha of letting go is staring you in the face. That time, above all, should be the time for teaching the Dhamma. Just to be in the knowing. Let go of the doer. Let go. If you have someone who is amenable to Dhamma, that's what you should tell them on their deathbed. Let go. Not just of their possessions, let go of their body. And if they're very wise, let go of their consciousness as well. So they might desire to die and end his life and loved ones' sufferings as well. Sometimes you cannot end other people's sufferings. It's just, when you say that you want to end your own suffering and end other people's sufferings as well, you have to just allow it to happen. It's called letting go. You can't make it happen. You can't force it happen. No more than you can force jhanas. If you try and die, the chances are you won't die. If you let it happen, then it's a good chance. It's like many people here have had trouble going to sleep at night. You can't even go to sleep at night, some of you. How do you think you're going to cause yourself to die? When you let go, be at peace. You don't even want to go to sleep. That's when you can go to sleep. Letting go. Letting go, forgetting and forgiving. Are they the same? Not forgetting, but forgiving, yes. Letting go is forgiving. Forgetting is a bit like being stupid. When you let go, all of your energy goes into mindfulness. When you're very mindful, you have a very good memory. You remember things said long ago. The times when people remember easily is, say, just before a car accident. Those of you who had a car accident, your mindfulness becomes very, very strong. Because you have to. This is dangerous. Your life is at stake. That's why car accidents, just beforehand, you can't stop remembering that. When mindfulness is enhanced, you always remember it. The other times you remember are the happy times. The times when you're happiest, your happy memories, you don't tend to forget them. Why? Because happiness also enhances your mindfulness. So, the more mindfulness you have, the easier it is to remember. If you don't enjoy school and lessons, you don't remember a word of what the teacher said. If the teacher makes the lessons happy and enjoyable, you remember them. Sometimes I ask people after I finish a talk, what did I talk about this evening? Sometimes they don't remember the title, all they remember is the jokes. Why is that? Because they're happy times, and that's when you're mindful. They always remember my jokes. Everything else I say, they don't forget straight away. My goodness. So this is what happiness or fear does. It increases mindfulness. That's why you remember. So letting go is not forgetting, but letting go, you remember more. Forgiving is letting go of the painful side of your memories. Next question. My goodness. Where'd you start? Some religions believe in karma and retributions, but some say that if, before death, should one confess his faith in that particular religion, he'll be absolved of all sins, which is true. Ha ha. You cannot stop the whole lifetime's momentum just in 1 minute, just before you die. It's true, even in Buddhism they say the last thought is important. That will determine your rebirth. So don't think you can go to the casino. You can play around with other people's wives. You don't need to go to the temple. You don't need to give any charity. You can just be selfish, cruel, intolerant, immoral. But there is the last moment of your life. You must be able to say, Buddhang Saranang Kachami, and then you'll be okay. Unfortunately, that will not work. Simply say you won't be able to say that for a start. But number two, even if you did manage to say that, just the whole momentum of your life, just one blip does not sort of stop the whole current, the whole river. It's the same that even if somebody comes along and converts you to being a Christian, you can't convert to being a Christian by going through some ceremony. No more than I can convert you into being an Australian just by sort of saying, do you believe in Australia? Yes, I believe in Australia. Now you're an Australian. No, of course you can't. That is really wishful thinking. The only people it makes happy is the pastor who goes away in a delusion thinking, oh, I've got another Christian. No, that's not true. After a person dies, if they've been a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim all their life and they get converted in their deathbed, as soon as they die, they're back to being a Christian again. They're back to being a Buddhist again, or a Hindu or Muslim. It's just like sometimes your husband, he's been naughty, he's misbehaved, and he says, wife, I promise I'll never do it again. How long does that last? Next day, they're doing the same thing again, aren't they? You can't just do this, especially when you're about to die. You haven't got your full senses with you. Even a confession on a deathbed probably wouldn't, I'm not quite sure if it's allowed in a court of law. But I can see that a confession that I did this, I did that on your deathbed. For a start, your mindfulness is very weak. You're dying, you're concerned with pain and other things. And who knows whether what you're saying is correct or not. It's probably unreliable. If you've got to convert, you've got to convert with your full faculties, when you're at peace, with freedom. And then it might have some power to it. But just on the deathbed, it's got no power at all. If any Buddhist does that, if you see a Buddhist being converted on their deathbed, they'll probably only do it to get rid of the pastor. You know what it is that sometimes, okay, I'll do it, just to get rid of you. And afterwards, when they're doing it, if you look very carefully, they've got their fingers crossed behind their back. I'm just doing this to get a bit of peace and quiet. Because it's not done with mindfulness. It's not done with deliberation, with consideration, with really thinking deeply about the consequences. In the same way, you can't just decide to be a Buddhist. It takes years to become a Buddhist, to feel the teaching, to get to know them, to accept them, to realize that that's you. A leopard doesn't change its spots, is the old saying. And the person who's been like one way all their life can't suddenly change. The others say, you cannot teach an old horse new tricks. When you're dead, you are an old horse. It's an old dog, isn't it? Not a whole horse, an old dog. Same thing. Also, I've heard that the gods of the monotheistic religions are merely equivalent to the devas. Is this true? Yes. According to the phrase, forgive and forget, I think is a way to let go, but I forgive, but do not forget. Does it mean that I haven't let go yet? Please advise. I've already answered that. When you forgive, you don't forget. You learn from those experiences. They're important experiences in your life. You forgive yourself, meaning you don't punish yourself. But you always remember never to do that again. You learn your lesson, and lessons you never forget, but you don't punish yourself, which is mean forgiving. The best happiness is to let go of what I hold most precious and dear. Does this apply to relationships? Yes. To let go in a relationship means to give your partner freedom. Now, this is a powerful thing about relationships. To give your partner freedom means to say to them, the door of my heart is always open to you no matter what you do. To trust them. If you love someone, surely you should trust them. If you don't trust them, then what sort of relationship is that? If you trust them, 99% of people will live up to that trust. They will live up to that love. So you let go to love. Imagine that your partner said to you, Don, I love you no matter what you ever do. I love you for who you are. Wherever you go, the door of my heart will always be open to you. How would you react to someone who said that? You'd love them even more. The simile is of keeping a bird. If you keep a bird in a locked cage, you never let that door open. Then one day when that door does become open, the bird will fly away and will never come back. It feels constrained, constricted. It feels in a prison. Some relationships are like that. One of the partners feels in a prison. They feel constricted, not trusted, they're not free. The other way of keeping a bird is you make the cage so beautiful, the food is so delicious, it's so wonderful being in that cage, you can leave the door open. And the bird, even if it does go away, will not go away for more than 5 minutes, will come back again. Because of kindness, because of love, because it wants to be with you. Now that's with the relationship. You can't control your partner. You can't possess them. The more you try and possess them, the more the other partner feels in the prison. The relationship will not last. Possessive relationships, controlling relationships usually end in strife. Loving relationships are always freeing relationships. They work on another level, and they always are very, very faithful, very long-lasting. There's a much more powerful love. So you let go, you love, you liberate, the same word, in a relationship. Let's keep going. What is the true intention of meditation? Should jhana be the aim when we meditate? The intention or the goal should be third noble truth, which is to let go, to be content, to meditate not expecting anything. The Dharma of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, works on all parts of our practice, on sila, on samadhi, on panya. Meditation is not exempt from the framework of the Four Noble Truths. So if you want to know what to do to meditate, be at peace. Have this wonderful relationship with your meditation which gives you freedom. Then if your mind does go wandering off like the bird, it will always come back again. Why? Because you've got such a wonderful, beautiful, kind, peaceful mind. You make your peace with the mind. When you make peace, you have peace. In the same way, if you want money, if you want to have money, you have to make money. If you make peace, you have peace. When you have peace, then you're still. When you're still, jhanas come. Jhanas are just stages of letting go. They're stages of happiness, incredible stages of happiness. And this is what happens. You can never aim for jhanas. You can never want jhanas. Well, at least if you do want them, you never get them. They happen naturally when you let go. If you want to hear more about that, that is the title of tomorrow night's talk. What's the title? Why let go or something? Or why stop? Why stop? Or jhanas? Buddhism teaches us about anatta non-self. Is it true then? Who is a bearer of karma? No one bears karma. Just as how does a fax go from one country to another? When a fax goes from one country to another, is it taken by a postman? Can you actually see that fax halfway between Perth and Penang? All that happens is a piece of paper goes in one end, and it comes out another end later on. There is no postman taking that message. Like karma, it's called action at a distance. No one stores karma, but there's a potential there at any moment. That's how karma works. It's non-self, just part of the process. Now, I'll give some more examples when I talk about deep insight in a couple of days' time. Ajahn Brahmawangso, it's called letting go. It's really going now. The last thought before death apparently has an effect on our rebirth. But how is it true of the karma to be reborn as a something? Then the last thought is good deeds, can it replace it? Okay, please, out of compassion and kindness for me, please write in a legible hand. Take your time, please. Because sometimes I can't read these things. So, but that must be my karma. How is it true? So I've already, I think, mentioned that. So the last thoughts. Yeah, in one way of looking at it, but the last thoughts are just the sum of all the other thoughts you've had in your life. It's a culmination of all the thoughts as your last thought. So you can't suddenly decide to change. The last thought is made of the karma of the past. Very rude. In subduing anger, there's a lot of thoughts here. Okay, in subduing anger, I was taught to dissect the person that made me angry into 32 parts of the body. I hope you don't dissect them with a knife. They said, in subduing anger, I was taught to dissect the person that made me angry. None of the 32 parts made me angry. I realized that it was the person's thoughts, deeds and actions that made me angry. Perhaps now I've found a reason to be angry. Ajahn, please correct me if my wrong view. Yeah, you can. The person doesn't make you angry. You make you angry. I've seen people. This was an experience in Perth years ago. I was being driven in a car into town. We stopped at a red light on one of these highways. There was another car stopped right next to us at the red light. That man in the other car was swearing at the traffic light. You stupid traffic light. Why do you turn red? You knew I was in a hurry. It's not the first time you did this either. You were just orange. You let the car in front of me through, but you stopped for me. This is unfair. He's getting angry at the traffic light. Have you seen people get angry at traffic lights? Have you got angry at your computer? Has a computer got it in for you? Does it really know that you really need this assignment in today and it crashes? And it's not the first time it's done that. I could imagine that man when he went to see his wife. And he was late for an appointment. His wife says, "Husband, why are you late? You did this on purpose, didn't you? It's not the first time you did this." You can get angry at anything. Is it the husband's fault that he's late? Is it the traffic light's fault for turning red? It's no one's fault except the person who gets angry. No one can make you angry. You make you angry. It's your karma, not theirs. when you're enlightened, no one can make you angry. They may say whatever they like to you. When they say, they call me Ajahn Brah, I think that's temporary insanity. I'm not going to allow you to make me angry. You come up to me and say, Ajahn Brah, that was the worst talk I've ever heard. I'm going to convert to being a Christian this evening. I'm going to go straight to church. I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to allow you to make me angry. Why allow anyone to control your happiness? That's what you do when you allow people to make you angry. You allow your wife to control your happiness. You allow your husband to control your happiness. Why allow anyone to make you angry? So this is how. It's you who make you angry. You can dissect a traffic light into 32 parts as well. Or more. That's what happens. Doubting what is doubtful, but doubting unnecessarily obstructs spiritual progress. Can Ajahn give examples of doubting unnecessarily? Sometimes doubt is an obsession. So sometimes we wonder about everything. What's going to happen next? Am I going to be able to get on my plane when I get to the airport or whenever it is? Am I going to leave? Is somebody going to... this is what happened to me in Singapore. I was about to leave Singapore to go back to Perth. They took me to breakfast. And after breakfast, they were really, really late. They wouldn't let me leave. And I was rushing, actually, to get on the plane on time. But then when you went to the gate, the departure gate, they insisted on having photographs. When I actually got through, I was the last person on the plane. I think they were doing this on purpose to make sure I stayed another day to give some more talks. When I say that, don't get any ideas. Say, doubting. Who cares anyway? You don't know the future. So trying to guess the future is doubting unnecessarily. Will it happen? Will it not happen? What will happen? How will it happen? That's doubting unnecessarily. What happened in the past? Who did this? What did they say? That's also doubting unnecessarily. The past is gone. You're never sure exactly what happened. The future is also uncertain. So shut up. Be still. Don't doubt. I'll talk about that in another couple of days, going through the hindrances. In the Kalama Sutra, we advise not to accept views, teachings merely because they conform with our own logical thinking, or merely because we are comfortable with them. Most of us human beings with limited wisdom accept unfair religion because we are comfortable with it, and the views seem to be logical to us. Then what is the fault of using logical thinking and intuition to verify certain views or teachings? What the Buddha says in the Kalama Sutra is the teaching should be logical, but they should be much more than logical. So you shouldn't accept a teaching just because they appear logical. But you should certainly never accept a teaching because it's illogical. So it's more than logical. Logic is not enough. Science is logical. But you have to go much further than science. You have to get more data than science knows. The data of the mind. To get more experience. So in the Kalama Sutra, the Buddha said, you should not accept these things just because it's logic or just because it's tradition. Tradition is important. It's an indicator that something has worked for many years. Logic is important. At least it stops you accepting stupid traditions. But go further. Go to experience. Now the important part, and I'll talk about this when I talk about deep insight. The only time you can trust your experience is when the five hindrances have been abandoned. Before then, your experience is liable to be bent by ill will. That's called denial. It's liable to be distorted by wishful thinking. And you've all heard me give examples of that. I've already given one example of distorted thinking, of rather like a denial, with that lady who couldn't see the sexual abuse of her children. The other example of wishful thinking, you've heard me say last year when I was here, when is it that people fall in love? When you go romancing, when you want a romantic evening, where do you go? Do you go to Mahinda Rama Temple to listen to Ajahn Brah? Forget it. You never get romance from this monk. You go to a nightclub where it's dark. you have a candlelit dinner where it's also very dim. Or you take your loved one for a walk in the moonlight. Have you ever noticed that the most romantic places are always where it's so dark you can't see what you're going out with? Because when you can't see what you're going out with, wishful thinking, the distortion of truth is enough to make that man just like a film star. Just like David Beckham, if you like David Beckham. And your wife is just like this amazing, beautiful supermodel in the moonlight. Because you can't see clearly, distorted thinking based on wishful thinking can work wonders. You will never fall in love in the middle of the day with the lights up. Now that's why you can never see the truth when you have the five hindrances of sensory desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness or doubt. The only time you can trust wisdom, trust experience, is when those hindrances are gone. That's another reason why we practice jhana, to eradicate the hindrances, to see the way things truly are. Not what we want to see, not what we like to see. Even what we don't like to see, we see. Even what's fearful, if it's true, we see it. Only when the five hindrances are gone. So, this is what the Kalama Sutra really meant. It meant the only truth which you can trust in the world is a truth based on experience when the five hindrances are gone. We meditate, especially jhanas, to eradicate those five hindrances temporarily, to see the truth. And that's the only truth we can trust. I'll mention more about that in the talk on Deep Insight. In the Noble Eightfold Path, oh no, I didn't spend off first, but first, yeah, that one's been done. In Malaysia, it is easy to get pirated softwares, music CDs and video CDs. Can you get pirated CDs of Ajahn Brahm? No, I give free permission to anybody who can pirate any of my CDs. Is it wrong to buy pirated CDs, as in breaking the second precept? Does it constitute to wrong livelihood for the person who sells pirated CDs? Now, that's very similar to the question I mentioned yesterday when I was doing a radio program and somebody rang up and asked, I'm having an affair with a woman, my wife doesn't know, is that wrong? My answer was, if it was right, you wouldn't have asked me. If it was right to get pirated CDs, you wouldn't have written this question. Someone's been naughty. How to use a psychological way to share this rightful teaching with someone who is ambitious and business-minded. Okay, if ambitious and business-minded, this is the way to become rich beyond your wildest dreams. People go to these wealth seminars. You see them in hotels with these guys from America. They dress up in flash suits with really expensive hairdos. And they go around charging you lots of money to actually teach exactly the same what I teach here for free. Maybe you should buy me a suit. Give me a slick hairdo. And I'll charge people $100, $200 just to come in the door. Then your ambitious business person would come in. Isn't it a case of marketing, isn't it? That's what it is, marketing. That's why sometimes people, when you make it for free, a lot of people don't come. You know that story? Someone rang up, one of our monks, said, I hear you teach meditation. He said, yes, I teach meditation. It was an American lady. Do you teach meditation? Yes, madam, I teach meditation. How much do you charge? This American woman said. I charge nothing, madam. She replied, then you can't be any good. And she hung up the phone. Why is it that we actually happened? Why is it we think that the more you pay, the better it must be? That's why these days, on Buddhist talks, we never say there's no charge. We never say this talk this evening is free. This talk is not free. It is priceless. Yeah, it's a priceless talk. So that's actually how you use a bit of psychology to get them in here. But this is the way to be ambitious. Buddhist teachings are not just for meditation. They're not just for monks or nuns. They're not just for people keeping 8 precepts. They actually help you. Yeah, they help your business. They help you become rich. You don't make so many mistakes. They help you pass your exams in university. They give you the edge. Look, in business, it's so competitive. You've got to be really alert. That's mindfulness. You've got to learn how to rest so you don't get stressed out and make mistakes. That's letting go. You've got to be trustworthy to be able to get your clients to know that you are trustworthy and you're going to supply whatever they order. That's morality. You've got to be able to see the opportunities which come before your competitors do. That's wisdom. All the teachings of the Buddha can be applied to business, and your businesses succeed where others fail. Maybe next time I come to Penang, the title of the talk will be Big Buddhism and Big Business. And charge people to come in. We'll give it back to them afterwards, but charge them to come in. Bad karma will lead to sufferings. Will the next generation be affected? Yeah, we are affected. If you make bad karma and you suffer, I'm affected. There's so many people who love you and care for you. So whatever you do affects many, many people. If you hurt, if you do stupid things, your parents get really upset. They're hurt. Your friends get hurt. Anyone who cares and loves you gets hurt. So that's one way why we should always be good people. For the sake of our parents. For the sake of our loved ones. For the sake of our friends. Even for the sake of the monks who look after you. So yeah, not only the next generation, but this generation hurts. That's why there is a sense of interconnectedness there. If we can't do it for the sake of ourselves, do it for the sake of others. Be good. Question, how would you solve the problem of someone being charmed by evil spells? Yeah. Again, you can only be charmed by evil spells if you allow yourself to be. Now, only people who break their precepts can actually be subject to bad spells. This is a story of, in Perth some years ago, a Thai girl, one of our supporters, brought her mother from Thailand because there was no one really looking after her mother. Her mother was old. So come to Thailand, come to Perth, Australia, I'll look after you. And so her mum came and lived with her at home, and she looked after her so well. After a few years, her mother became sick and was put in hospital. The doctors really didn't know what was wrong with her. It looked bad, but they couldn't really give any diagnosis or say what was going to happen. So this Thai girl went to a medium, a woman who could go into trance. She was quite well known in Perth. And she paid this medium $20. It was quite cheap. $20 to go into trance to find out whether her mother would live or would die, would survive the illness. So the medium first of all asked, what's your mother's name? In what hospital is she in? What ward, what room number? Because the medium would leave her body, astral travel, and check on the status of this girl's mum. So, having given her the details, having passed over the $20, this medium went into a trance, but went unconscious for about 20 minutes, half an hour. When she came out of the trance, she opened her eyes and gave the $20 back. She said, I left my body. I went to that hospital. I found that ward. I found that room. But I couldn't go in. She said, I don't know who your mother is. I've never seen this before. There was a force field around your mother. I couldn't penetrate it. So I can't really find out whether your mum's going to live or die. Here's the $20 back. But if you don't mind me asking, what has your mother been doing? And the Thai girl said, my mother is a Mer Chi. She's a Thai nun. She's been keeping the eight precepts for about 30 years. And at that, the medium got very angry. You stupid girl, why didn't you tell me that beforehand? I can't get close to people like that. You just made me waste my time. Bad people can't get close to you. If you keep your precepts, this medium saw it as a force field surrounding that person. They just can't get close. And that's one story out of many. The people who keep five precepts become immune to any bad spells. And if someone tries to put a bad spell on you, it actually rebounds on them. They get hurt. They just can't do it. And I told you the story about the gypsy the other day. My spells are much more powerful than bad people's. Be careful. It's very, very rare that someone's actually got a bad spell on them. Very often the people who are, you think are in trance or you think are somehow affected, that in most cases, 95% is a psychiatric problem. Paranoia, schizophrenia. It's best dealt with a doctor, with a psychiatrist, with a pill to knock them out of that stupidity. But, no, I've got too many questions. I won't tell that story about Ajahn Chah another time. May I ask you a question? That's your question, that's number one. Go on. Yes, you do. Were you the person who says in the Astro Discovery Channel on the adoption series, a real parent is not the one who bears children but raises children. I wasn't the one who said that on the Astro Discovery Channel, but a real parent is not the one who bears children but raises children. Yeah, I suppose that's a good saying, because if you adopt a child, then you actually do the work of a parent. So I suppose really you are the real parent, the one who does the work. So yeah, it's true, because that child, you may give it a body, it may have your genes, but it does not have your character. The genes only give a body, and that person comes from another realm, another place, with their past karma, and that is the most important part of a child, the karma they bring into this life from the past. What role do nuns play in nowadays society? Is it dangerous for females to live in accordance with forest tradition? And how could one renounce when knowing parents would be sad? Thank you, Ajahn Bhamwansa. Nuns will have to play an increasing role in today's Buddhist society. Both monks and nuns are necessary in today's society. There are not enough monks to go around. There never will be. So we should have nuns as well to be teachers, to also help roll the wheel of the Dhamma. Whenever this question comes up, I say, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Too many people complain about where are the nuns in Buddhism, not enough women are joining up to be nuns. Rather light a candle than complain about darkness. If no one wants to become a nun, how can we have nuns? Number two, we need places where people can become nuns. So again, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. A few years ago, I started a nun's monastery in Western Australia, which is growing. But still, it takes a while for people to really commit themselves to being nuns. They live in a forest, 600-acre forest, 2 kilometers long, 1 kilometer wide. There's only two nuns there at the moment, so they've got a square kilometer each. There's room for improvement. And how can one renounce when knowing one's parents would be sad? You send your parents to Ajahn Brahm or to someone else. And I tell them, look, Parents, if your child wants to renounce and you say no, when you stand in the way of someone making good karma, and that's a wonderful way to make good karma, be a monk or a nun, then you are making very, very bad karma. Any parent who stops their child becoming a monk or a nun makes bad karma. Imagine if my mother or father stood in my way, then I wouldn't be here to teach Dhamma. Imagine what bad karma they would have made if they stopped me becoming a monk And I tell people that it's bad karma to stop a person going to a temple to make some meritorious dana. It's bad karma to stop people keeping the precepts. It's bad karma to stop people ordaining. It's bad karma to stop someone coming to a retreat. If you stop someone else making good karma, that is bad karma. If you encourage someone to make good karma, then that is your own good karma. If you encourage someone to give a donation, that is good karma. If you encourage someone to keep precepts, that is your good karma by encouraging them. If you encourage someone to go to a temple, that is good karma. If you encourage someone to come on a retreat, that's your good karma. If you encourage someone to ordain as a monk or a nun, that is your good karma. You're helping give the gift of Dhamma. So, please pass that around. We have not enough monks and nuns in our society, and sometimes it's the parents, because they don't know Buddhism, they're superstitious, they don't know what bad karma they're doing by stopping their monks or their children becoming monks or nuns. Please don't do that. Okay, it's 10:05, and it takes 5 minutes to run to the gate, because it closes at 10:15. So better stop now. So thank you for listening to these questions and the talk about letting go. Now I will let you go, but only after giving the sharing of merits. So please join in with me. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.